like a parachutist. Paul let his knees bend deeply, using all his legs to absorb the impact. He woofed out a big grunt of air, clouding his visor with his breath. But he was standing on the ground again. No broken bones. Just a little twinge in his right ankle. Otherwise, everything was okay. He took a deep breath, turned up his helmet fan to clear the fog from his visor, and started out across the plain once again. I must have saved at least 15 minutes, he told himself, not daring to look at his watch or make an estimate of how much oxygen might be left in his backpack tank. The ankle hurt enough to make him limp. Board meeting. Paul's personal jet was subsonic, so he expected to arrive in New York hours later than Bradley Arnold. He had rushed from his office to the corporation's airstrip, where Joanna was waiting for him, eager to tell her about what McPherson had learned. But before he could start to break the news to her, Joanna asked, "Aren't all these personal planes an expense we can cut down on?" She was buckling herself into the co-pilot's seat on Paul's right. "You can bring it up as new business at the meeting," he answered, watching over the plane's stubby nose as the ground crew disconnected the towing tractor from the nose wheel.
"Perhaps I should," Joanna said.
Paul ran up the engines, his eyes on the indicators of the control panel, amused at the no-nonsense tone of Joanna's voice. She was taking her responsibilities as a board member seriously. "Before you do," he said over the muted howl of the jets, "you ought to check out the efficiency study we commissioned last year." He eased off the brake pedals and the plane rolled forward. Paul slipped on his headset as he maneuvered the plane toward the end of the runway. He got his clearance from the tower, pushed the throttles to full power, and the twin jet hurtled down the runway and arrowed into the sky. Once they were on course for LaGuardia, Paul slipped the headset down over his neck.
"I presume," Joanna said, "that the efficiency report says your personal planes are the only thing standing between us and utter bankruptcy."
He grinned at her. "Not quite. But the report does endorse the planes. Saves the top executives a lot of time, and time is our most precious commodity." Joanna looked unconvinced.
"Another report that says exactly what its readers want to hear."
"The best consultants money can buy," Paul said.
"I'm sure."
More seriously, Paul said, "I got a report from McPherson this afternoon."
"About Gregory?"
Joanna tensed visibly. "He had terminal cancer of the prostate," Paul told her. "That's why he killed himself." She was silent for a long time. Paul let her absorb the information, sort out her feelings. He looked out at the clouds below, like a range of massive white mountains, but alive, dynamic, billowing up and reaching toward them. Above the clouds, everything always seemed so much better, cleaner. The sun was always shining up here. The sky was always bright blue.
"Then he didn't know about us after all," Joanna said at last.
"Or didn't care. He had other problems."
"He never had much of a tolerance for pain," Joanna murmured,
so low that Paul could hardly hear her over the engines.
"His own pain, that is."
"He killed himself to end his pain," Paul said. Joanna nodded, her face unreadable. Paul heard a sudden burst of chatter in his earphone. He pulled the headset back on. "Masterson 101, he said crisply into the pinhead microphone. "Repeat, please." "101, this is Masterson Base. Paul, we just got word that Mr. Arnold's plane has gone down."
"What?"
Automatically, Paul reached for the intercom switch on the control panel and flicked it on so Joanna could hear the radio transmission too. "Arnold's plane is down, over the Atlantic. Coast Guard sent out search planes, but they don't expect any survivors." "What happened?" Paul demanded.
"Dunno.
Got one Mayday transmission that said they'd lost power on both engines."
"Holy God."
They flew in silence for a while, Paul's mind churning. Brad's gone. That supersonic blowtorch of his has the glide ratio of a grand piano. Must have hit the water like a bomb. Cripes, what a blow. But a part of his mind was thinking that with Arnold out of the way, Greg had no one of real importance backing him on the board of directors. "This strengthens my hand. A lot," he told himself. He looked over at Joanna. She seemed lost in thought also. weighing the odds, he knew, trying to figure out how the balance of power has shifted. Just like I am. The board meeting went on anyway. Most of the directors had come from considerable distances to attend the emergency meeting. The old days when the rich and powerful lived in or near New York were long gone. Now the directors came from Tucson and Aspen, Houston and Sarasota, Seattle and Hilo. Several had flown in from Europe and the Asian Rim. The vice chairperson, a white-haired, superannuated woman who had once been the corporation's director of personnel, seemed staggered when Paul told her that Arnold was dead.
"First Gregory and now Brad," she whispered.
She easily agreed to let Paul run the meeting. Paul thought she was eager to escape the responsibility. Leaving Arnold's seat at the head of the table vacant, Paul convened the meeting and broke the news to the stunned board.
"My God," said one of the older directors, his hair white, his skin gray. "Who's next?"
"I move that we observe a minute of silence for our late chairman," said Greg. He sat halfway down the table, wearing his usual black business suit. He had not even glanced at Melissa, sitting at the end of the table. Paul thought that either he really did hate her now, or they were putting on a damn good act. Once the minute of silence ended, Paul said, "I suppose we should elect a new chairman right away." Heads bobbed agreement. Directors turned in their chairs, murmured to one another. "I suggest we take a 15-minute break," Paul said, "then reconvene to hear nominations." They didn't even bother to vote, just pushed their chairs back and headed for the bar and snacks at the back of the meeting room. Paul saw that the directors clumped into knots of threes and fours, plenty of whispered conversations, plenty of sudden, desperate politicking. Joanna came up to his side. "Do you have a nominee in mind?" she asked. Surprised, Paul admitted, "No, I haven't even thought about it." Before Joanna could say anything more, Greg stepped between them. "I need to talk to you," he said to Paul, pointedly turning his back to his mother.
"You can talk to both of us," Paul said, shifting sideways a step so that he was once more side by side with Joanna.
"Certainly," Greg said tightly.
"So?" Paul prompted.
"You were out at the nanotech division, right?"
Paul nodded.
"Several board members want to shut it down."
Joanna said, "It's going to be years before it has any hope of showing a profit."
"Just like Moonbase," Greg snapped.
"What are you driving at?" Paul demanded.
"Just this. You vote to keep the nanotech division going, and I'll vote to keep Moonbase going."
Paul blinked with surprise.
"You'll back Moonbase?"
"If you'll back the nanotech division."
Glancing at Joanna, Paul thought, this is the way a corporation goes broke. Everybody's got his own pet project that he wants to keep alive so nobody kills anything and we all go down the tubes. Almost as if he could read Paul's thoughts, Greg said,
"Chris Cardenas showed you the lunar construction demo, didn't she?"
"That's right."
"Well, why don't we pool our interests and set up a demonstration on the moon?"
"Demonstration of what?" Joanna asked.
"Nanotech construction," Greg told his mother. "Set up a construction task for the nanomachines at Moonbase. Use it to prove that we can build lunar facilities at a fraction of today's costs."
"I don't understand," Joanna said. Feeling suddenly enthusiastic, Paul jumped in.
"We can send a handful of nanomachines up to Moonbase and have them construct new facilities out of regolith materials."
"Right," said Greg.
"Can that be done? I mean, now? Today?"
"In a few months," Greg replied.
Paul said, "If the demonstration works, we can cut the costs of Moonbase by half or more. And prove to the world that nanotechnology has useful applications here and now," Greg added.
Joanna looked from her son to her husband, then back again.
"Greg, that's beautiful."
"I think it can work," Greg said. "I'm certain it could work."
"You might be right," Paul admitted.
"Cripes, we could build a viable moon base right away and start making a profit off it within a couple of years."
"Or sooner," said Greg.
Joanna smiled happily.
"This is a fine idea, Greg."
"You're right," Paul agreed. Greg put his hand out. "Can we work together on this? You and me, Paul?"
Grabbing his proffered hand in his own, Paul said, "Damned right."
"Good," said Greg, beaming. "And once the meeting reconvenes, I've got another little surprise for you."
Paul looked at his wristwatch. "Hey, we'd better get them back to work."
It took a few minutes to get the